You're listening to The Hour of the Time on 2.
And I'm William Cooper.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, and under God.
What's next?
Indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
That's good. You didn't even need any help.
Yeah, I almost forgot the whole thing.
That's the first time, huh?
Yeah.
Well, everybody makes mistakes, and you're entitled.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You know, folks, my mom has a cold today.
She does?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you run down and take care of her? Bundle her all up and keep her warm.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye, folks.
Bye, Pooh.
Bye.
Well, tonight, as promised, every Thursday, we have Frank Marzullo on the line. Good evening, Frank.
Good evening, Bill. How's it going for you this week?
Good. How's the market?
The market has been interesting. We're getting a lot of information. There's several things pointed out in the Wall Street Journal. We pretty much started the week right around pushing 390 gold with a Dow at 5159. Silver was up as well, and through the week we saw some pullbacks in the prices of metal, pretty much closing out today with gold at 385.80, silver at 509. The Dow briefly had broke above 5,200, actually closed yesterday above 5,200, went a little bit higher today and had some significant pullbacks to close at 5,182. But according to the Wall Street Journal, there's several things that, and like we talked about last week, significant speculation that we're going to see a capital gains tax cut next year. Sometime passed during the year, made retroactive to January 1. And all this action on the Dow, when you take the trillions of dollars that are in the stock market and you focus them on a few issues, you can obviously drive the prices quite high and have significant percentage increases in value. Well, hey, you're making big bucks. Next year, capital gains tax cut. Speculation grows that a popular year-end technique may be killed or altered. Basically, what we see going on right now is what's called selling short against the box. It's a tax deferral technique by which they generate a lot of activity, and they don't have to come up with the money or take profits until January. So that's what's going on with all this Dow action and these record moves and all this other nonsense that, like we talked about last week when we went through and explained all that, really and truly isn't anything wonderful at all. We talked, before we clicked on the air, I was asking about Phil Marsh. The pressure that people are putting on the IRS by getting out, my understanding is what, some 46 million people have now detaxed?
I believe it's much higher than that. In fact, I believe the figures are so high that you're never going to hear the accurate figure.
Well, I'd have to agree with you, but the IRS quietly has altered the wording in its employee manual. Now a taxpayer's disclosure will no longer be considered voluntary. If anyone from the IRS has launched an inquiry, such as a civil audit, an IRS official said in an interview. And they're also talking about restructuring the IRS. They're putting together a new commission created in a provision in the Treasury's appropriation bill signed into law recently by Clinton. So it looks to me like the pressure that we're putting on them with what we're doing is working.
Well, you know, they can change it all they want to. The fact remains they're an illegal, unconstitutional organization.
Why?
That is the representative of a foreign power.
Mm-hmm.
And people who know that and know how to deal with them are still not going to be affected by them.
Oh, exactly. And the more and more people that choose to not deal with them, that's the stronger we become. But back, you know, a little bit on the metals market, back to that. During the first 6 months of 1995, we wonder, well, why hasn't gold gone anywhere? You know, it's just been kind of languishing around. Belgium alone, the country of Belgium alone, in the first 6 months of 1995, dumped 244 metric tons of gold into the market. Again, perception issue. Keep the price of gold down. If people see the Dow going up or, you know, pretty much remaining up there and gold staying down, hey, there's nothing to worry about, is there? And as long as people buy into that, they're going to go ahead and dump the gold into the market.
Well, they've been dumping an awful lot of it because more people are buying gold today than at any time in history. In fact,
exactly.
I have something here that you're going to be interested in. On Good Morning America, the Sunday before the 2nd of December, they provided some extremely interesting statistics at the end of their obligatory Thanksgiving weekend holiday shopping consumer confidence report, you know, like they always give. And the conclusion was that even though the economy is booming, consumers are unconvinced. In fact, they're being so cautious in their gift buying that these are the three top-selling gifts. Number one is home computers. Number two is gold. Number three is guns and ammunition. Now, that's on Good Morning America.
Now, do you think that the people out there know that they're being lied to on the media so they get their computers for an alternative source of information through bulletin boards and, you know, the Internet and the rest of it? They're getting the gold because they don't believe in the monetary system, and they're getting the guns for obviously, you know...
For obvious reasons that nobody has to discuss.
Exactly. But that's interesting. With all the gold that's going out there, 244 tons by Belgium alone, that's over three times all of 1994 central bank sales.
Yes.
The market just sucks it up, and the price just keeps on, it keeps on working its way up, and they've got to dump more and more, and they're running out. They're rapidly running out of the available metal to manipulate the market with. And the other thing that was discussed, this is by Peter Cardillo of Westfalia of Investments, they may be using this as a way to align currency values to bring us into a single currency. Now, what we other also saw this week was more and more discussion, the little nickel and dime pokes about the old Federal Reserve notes, the problem with counterfeiting. Now, Greenspan got up there and said $9 out of every million is counterfeit. And yet that's the only reason they use to come up with a new note, is to combat counterfeiting. To me, that's not enough of a reason to do so. But again, you and I and others know differently the contractual nature of these things, that they're subtly different enough that under UCC, you don't have to be honored at one for one.
That's right. In fact, the actual contract no longer appears. It says something like legal tender, but that's about it. It has no contract whatsoever as even a pretension of money.
Exactly. So the reality is people are going to get bushwhacked here, and it's looking like it's pretty soon. Well, I love reading Veritas because my favorite column is the whole thing on the symbolism. We've just all been this past week, it ends this evening, guy married to Fonda. His little network here, he just all brought us through the York Wright thing, 13 Days of James Bond.
Oh, you're talking about the Communist News Network?
Yeah, Ted Fonda, yeah, and his TBS, his superstation.
Ted Turncoat, he's married to Hanoi Jane.
Yeah, we've given 13, we brought up all the 13 degrees of York Wright through the James Bond series, and when you understand the symbolism, when you understand how they speak with allegory, and you watch these things, you can see they're telling you what they're going to do.
And they're also laughing at us. I believe it's Moonraker, where Bond crashes through a wall of this big warehouse, and there they are in there staging the moon landing.
Yeah.
And filming it with cameras.
the biggest thing is, it's getting close. Because you can see the different rights, you can see York Right, you can see Scottish Right, you can see some of the other factions starting to put out more and more warnings to their members.
Yeah.
I've had the pleasure of meeting an eighth generation Shriner, and who's on our side, who had never read Morals and Dogma. He just happened to have a very important position, and he was given the honorary degrees and worked his way up. And I shared with him a lot of the things that I'd learned from listening to you and reading Scarlet and the Beast, and he accepted it. He said, 5 years ago, I would have slapped you and said, that there was just no way. He says, but he's been seeing some things lately that he had started to believe that something was wrong, and now he recognizes there is indeed a dark side, and it is being used to manipulate a large amount of the brothers that are in the craft.
Oh, yes.
But you know, he's been able to enlighten me to a lot of the little things. It's very interesting, but it's close. It's so close that it's absolutely unbelievable.
Now, the Shriners and Freemasonry as a whole has always professed to be Christian, and they point to the open Bible on the altar. Why would Christians wear the red fez in the order known as the Shriners, when the origin of the fez was after a great battle during the Crusades, when they literally slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Christians, and the blood was running in the streets.
And the hats were blue or something before, right?
Yeah, and they took them off their head and soaked them in the blood of Christians, and since that day, it has been a badge representing the destruction of Christianity by the Muslim world.
But you really don't know that until you're made like a 33rd or you're one of the insiders. Most of these guys, like you've pointed out repeatedly, they think they're doing the right thing. They think they're working and, you know, the Shriners hospitals and all these other things that they do. You know, it's like, well, hey, it's just tradition. We wear these funny hats. They don't bother to look into the symbolism. They don't bother to look into the allegory about everything. They don't read the history of it. And they constantly are being manipulated. And it's unfortunate, but at least a lot of them are awakening, and that's the importance. That is very important that they are.
Well, I'll sure be glad when it happens on a massive scale.
I will too, but
we are in dire straits.
Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to have the time. It is appearing that, again, with a capital gains tax cut, we can expect first quarter sell-off, significant sell-off, profit-taking, and positioning there, and that'll precipitate a whole bunch of other problems as the market starts tumbling down. This $1 trillion credit run-up that we've seen lately, all of a sudden, people aren't going to have dividends or whatever they're relying on to pay their debts. We're going to see layoffs. We're going to see some serious problems this first quarter of 96.
Also, if they run true to form, in the tradition of Randy Weaver, April 19th, the Koresh Branch Davidians, April 19th, the Oklahoma City bombing, April 19th, then in the spring, somewhere around April 19th, you're going to see another great disaster.
Oh, I don't doubt it. If maybe on the April 19th, maybe along the lines of a more violent nature, I'd like to, you know, be great to talk with you when we have the time to go over what the possible dates before that or financial situation to develop.
March 25th.
What's March 25th? Where does that...
It's around the... the winter solstice on December the 25th. And then on March the 25th, or around there, within a few days, is the spring equinox.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the summer solstice. These are all important dates. Then in the satanic and the ancient religious calendars, you have specific events of sacrifice around the first week or two of April, which always calls for some blood to be spilled.
Mm-hmm.
But we can go into that another time. Are there any last words you want to impart to the listeners before we head on into the rest of the broadcast?
Just start laying groundwork. Get out of paper. You know, I realize that a lot of people don't want to take the hit. You know, they look at this, they look at that, it's like, oh my God, taxes this, taxes that. People, you better do something about it now while you have it to do something with.
Ditto.
Right.
Thank you, Frank.
We'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Well, folks, I have a letter here from a friend of mine, Mark, and I'm going to read you a portion of it, not all of it. Part of it's private. Part of it is things that are things that we are researching and cannot be revealed yet, but I want to read part of this to you because it will point out to you how an understanding of symbology and how listening to this broadcast can help connect you with what is happening in the real world. Without the knowledge of symbology, without the understanding of the explanation of the mysteries and the importance of the millennium and all of these things, the phallic worship of the mysteries, you could hear all of this and never even make any connections. But this is how you take disparate quotes, information, books, things that are said, and things that you pick up and put them together to paint a picture. And this is what Mark has done in his letter. So, anyway, he says, "It was truly an honor to speak with you on the phone the other day. I first met you at your 92 Atlanta seminar when you signed my copy of your book. Since that time, I have truly been enlightened through your shortwave show, your newspaper, and my own research, and am now teaching a weekly class on these subjects. God bless you always for what you are doing." The next paragraph I cannot disclose to you right now. "The following is information regarding the Promise Keepers movement, as we also discussed. The more I have looked between the lines of the Promise Keepers, the more I have realized they are encouraging ecumenism, a push for a one-world religion. One only has to look at Chuck Colson's involvement in order to throw up a red flag. Colson attended the recent Parliament of World Religions, which is working toward uniting all religions of the world into one. Colson, an ex-Watergate convict, received the $1 million Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion, which is partially Rockefeller-funded. Colson is involved with Promise Keepers, which seems to be pushing the same agenda as the Parliament of World Religions. What sheds some interesting light is an endorsement by Promise Keepers of a new released book by Christian author Jay Geary entitled The Star of 2000. It was given favorable reviews in the July-August 95 issue of the official Promise Keepers magazine, appropriately titled The New Man. Interesting title of a book given the Galileo, Arthur C. Clarke, Pope, and Marian visions, etc., attempt of a fake spiritual encounter at the turn of the millennium. Sure enough, this book advocates a bi-millennial celebration of Christ's 2000th birthday and jubilee. What a way to deceptively sneak an idea such as this into the Christian bookstores, an idea that the mysteries have had in mind for a long time. What most people don't seem to know is Jay Geary's association with none other than Robert Mueller, ex-Undersecretary General of the United Nations, New Age author who wrote New Genesis, Shaping a Global Spirituality, calling, guess what, for a one-world religion. Geary invited Mueller to be key advisor for his BEGIN, which stands for Bi-Millennial Global Interactive Network. In The Star of 2000, Geary recommends a book by Mueller called First Lady of the World, in which Mueller details suggestions on how the United Nations should prepare for the bi-millennial celebration. In Geary's March-April 1992 issue of Bi-Millennial Research Report, he recommends another Mueller book entitled, guess what, folks, The Birth of a Global Civilization, in which he describes it as an inspiring book at our emerging global system, including global celebrations culminating in the year 2000. You people keep writing and asking me, or calling on the air and asking me, how do I know that the year 2000 is going to be when they want to form their world government? It's no secret, folks. It's in all of their books, all their publications, all of their projected celebrations, in the government reports. It's everywhere. The year 2000 is the date that they want to have their world government in place. I don't think they're going to make it. but it won't be too far behind the year 2000, I can assure you, unless we wake more people up. He goes on. Another book being promoted by the Promise Keepers is The Masculine Journey by Robert Hicks, which teaches the concept of phallic worship in an indirect way. The book actually contains the Promise Keepers logo on it, and the acknowledgments on page 11 gives thanks and credit for this book to the Promise Keepers. It was said that 50,000 of these books were distributed at the Promise Keepers Convention in Boulder, Colorado, at Boulder 93. Here are some statements from the book. On page 51, it says, "Possessing a penis places unique requirements upon men before God in how they are to worship Him," end quote. And also on page 51, quote, "The phallus has always been the symbol of religious devotion and dedication," end quote. On page 54, quote, "Current Christianity cannot openly deal with or talk about the male phallus in its full sexual activity or fantasy," end quote. On page 68, quote, "As men, the phallus defines our identity," end quote. The chapter entitled "The Phallic Male" begins with a quote from the New Age bestseller, Fire in the Belly, by New Age author Sam Keen. A recent statement published by Promise Keepers said, quote, "We feel that the masculine journey is a valid resource for men to grow in Christ," end quote. I'm going to tell you right now, this is all out of the mystery schools. This is what the obelisk represents. When they talk about Christ, they're not talking about Jesus Christ. They're talking about an office that the whole human race is soon to fulfill. Those who will become Christed will survive and move into the new age. Those who cannot will not be allowed. I bet that's got you awake now, huh? Are you listening out there? Well, I hope you are. Now I have another communication from Daniel New, Michael New's father. And I'm going to read this to you because I think it's important. I do believe. He says, and this is why Michael New eventually will win. He'll probably lose the first battle in a military court, but he will ultimately win. He has to. He says, "The UN uniform is unauthorized and prohibited by law." And that's a fact. "There is no authority in the United States Constitution and no authorization in any U.S. statute enacted by the United States Congress for the U.S. President to order any member of the U.S. Armed Forces to wear any so-called United Nations uniform, including any United Nations insignia and any United Nations headgear as an augmentation of the American military uniform. There is no authorization in U.S. Army Regulation 670-1 on the wear and appearance of Army uniforms and insignia for the required wear or the voluntary wear of any United Nations insignia or any UN headgear to augment the U.S. Army uniform. U.S. Army Regulation 670-1, paragraph 1-4A, clearly states, quote, only uniforms, accessories, and insignia prescribed in this regulation or on the common table of allowance will be worn by personnel of the United States Army," end quote. Paragraph 26-3 of Regulation 670-1. Covers the types of berets and headgear that are authorized for wear with the battle dress uniform, but the UN blue beret is not listed in this chapter, nor is it authorized for wear with any uniform. Paragraph 27-16A and B of United States Army Regulation 670-1 mandates that the design of any shoulder sleeve insignia must be approved by the director of the Institute of Heraldry of the United States Army. But to date, no United Nations shoulder insignia has been designated or authorized by this body. Therefore, both UN insignia and UN headgear are clearly unauthorized items of uniform. More than that, The wearing of any United Nations insignia is strictly and expressly prohibited by United States Army Regulation 670-1, paragraph 3-4K, and paragraph 27-16C, which state, foreign badges, distinctive unit insignia, and regiment distinctive insignia will not be worn on battle dress uniforms. The authorization for shoulder sleeve insignia will not be granted for provisional units. Furthermore, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, Article 134, prohibits the wearing of unauthorized insignia, decorations, badge, ribbon, device, or lapel button. And furthermore, United States Code Section 702 provides criminal sanctions for unauthorized wearing of a United States military uniform. An official 1994 United Nations document on UN support for UNPROFOR in former Yugoslavia, which was the United Nations peacekeeping force, states that the ostensibly required United Nations insignia and headgear are supposed to be given as gifts furnished by the United Nations to all U.S. troops participating in United Nations peace operations. But 5 United States Code, Section 7342, specifically prohibits federal employees, including members of the armed forces, from accepting any gifts from foreign governments, specifically including the United Nations. There are statutes in the United States Code pursuant to acts of Congress which authorize voluntary wearing of certain foreign service medals and ribbons by members of the United States Armed Forces who engaged in foreign service in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. Certain medals have been approved by Congress for those who served as volunteers with the United Nations in peace observation operations, specifically only in Lebanon, Palestine, and India, Pakistan. There is no authorization from Congress for wearing any United Nations insignia of any sort in Macedonia or the former Republic of Yugoslavia. United Nations guidelines do require members of the United States Armed Forces to wear United Nations insignia and United Nations headgear. Unfortunately, this is not a proper legal American authority. In fact, this authorization is totally without American legal support. It is actually in conflict with the American Uniform Code of Military Justice, United States Army Regulations, and the United States Code. It is, in fact, prohibited by law. The United States Army alleges there is presumed legal authority by the United States President for the order to Specialist New to wear the augmented uniform with United States headgear and insignia. The wearing of an unauthorized and specifically prohibited uniform would be a clear-cut violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice itself and subject to felony criminal penalties under the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the United States Code. The court-martial of a soldier who refuses to obey an illegal order is itself patently illegal. I love it. I just love it. I can't stand it. I'm just so pleased with all of this. Not all of it, but a lot of it. Just tickles me pink, folks. Let me see here. What did I say I was going to do? let's do this, because I want to get into this book, Man-Made UFOs, 1944 to 1994. And I think you're going to be amazed, absolutely amazed. This is 420-some-odd pages, folks. It is a massive book. Not as thick as mine. Mine is 500 pages, but nevertheless, massive and full of facts, not the typical ufology bullshit.
Down and just a few years ago, ladies and gentlemen, before I get into this, let me make a statement about Veritas. Because Frank mentioned something about the column on symbology. We may not be running that column anymore because we're not getting any more submissions from the columnist. We don't know why, but he has failed to send submissions for this issue and the following issue as he's normally been doing. So I don't know what's going on with it. We'll find out. Not too long ago, a man by the name of W.A. Harbinson wrote a book called Genesis. I don't know how many of you may have read that book, but it was an amazing novel. A novel based upon some facts. In fact, he not only based it on some facts, but some real historical occurrences and some real historical people. And W.A. Harbinson, the author of Genesis, wrote the introduction to man-made UFOs 1944 to 1994, 50 Years of Suppression, which, by the way, was written by Renato Vesco and David Hatcher Childress. I'm going to read to you as much as I can tonight of W.A. Harbinson's introduction to this book, and I will continue with it tomorrow night. While Genesis is very much a work of fiction, it has been based on certain facts which this author feels are worth bringing to light. In the course of researching a different novel altogether, I obtained through the Imperial War Museum in London two short but intriguing articles which immediately captured my interest. The first one was a routine war report by Marshal Yarrow, then the Reuters special correspondent to Supreme Headquarters in liberated Paris. This article had been published, among other places, in the South Wales Argus on December the 13th, 1944, and it stated, and I quote, "The Germans have produced a secret weapon in keeping with the Christmas season. The new device, which is apparently an air defense weapon, resembles the glass balls which adorn Christmas trees. They have been seen hanging in the air over German territory, sometimes singly, sometimes in clusters. They are colored silver and are apparently transparent." The second article, an Associated Press release extracted from the New York Herald Tribune of January the 2nd, 1945, illuminated the subject even more. It said, and I quote, "Now it seems the Nazis have thrown something new into the night skies over Germany. It is the weird, mysterious Foo Fighter. Balls which race alongside the wings of bow fighters flying intruder missions over Germany. Pilots have been encountering this eerie weapon for more than a month in their night flights. No one apparently knows what this sky weapon is. The balls of fire appear suddenly and accompany the planes for miles. They seem to be radio controlled from the ground, so official intelligence reports reveal," end quote. Apparently, those unknown objects made their final appearance in May 1945, when the end of the war was in sight. Intrigued by these reports, I conducted some more research and discovered a highly technical but little-known book called Inter Cetateli Senza Sparari by Renato Vesco, in which the author claims that the Foo Fighter actually existed, that it was originally called the Führerball, and that it was first constructed at the aeronautical establishment at Weiner-Neustadt with the help of the Flugfunk Forschungsanstalt of Oberpfaffenhofen, or FFO. And forgive me if I don't pronounce these German names correctly. I don't even speak the German language, and so I am liable to make mistakes, but I will try my best. According to Vesco, the Führerball was a flat, circular, flying machine powered by a special turbojet engine, which was used by the Germans during the closing stages of the war, both as an anti-radar device and as a psychological weapon against Allied pilots. Says Vesco, quote, "The fiery halo around its perimeter, caused by a very rich fuel mixture, and the chemical additives that interrupted the flow of electricity by over-ionizing the atmosphere in the vicinity of the plane, generally around the wingtips or tail surfaces, subjected the H2S radar on the plane to the action of powerful electrostatic fields and electromagnetic impulses, end quote. Vesco also claims that the basic principles of the Führerball were later applied to a much larger symmetrical circular aircraft, the Kugelblitz, or ball lightning fighter, which was the first example of the vertical rising jet lift aircraft. Further intrigued, I continued my research in West Germany and came up with a surprising number of newspaper and magazine clippings, all from the 1950s, about one Flugkapitän Rudolf Schreiber. One clipping stated that this former Luftwaffe aeronautical engineer had designed in the spring of 1941 the prototype for a flying top, and that the device was tested in June 1942. Another stated that the same Flugkapitän Schreiber, with three trusted colleagues, had actually constructed in August 1943 a large specimen of his original flying disc, but at the summer of 1944, in the East Hall of the BMW, or Bavarian Motorworks plant near Prague, he had redesigned the original model, replacing its former gas turbine engines with some highly advanced form of jet propulsion, and a third, which reiterated the above information, added the interesting news that original plans for the flying disc had been drawn up by the German experts Habermal and Meith, and an Italian physicist, Dr. Balanzo. According to other reports, and subsequently to Major Rudolf Lusser's indispensable book entitled German Secret Weapons of World War II, end quote, English language edition, published by Neville Spearman, London, 1959, and the Philosophical Library, New York, 1959, Habermal and Schreiber had designed a large ring plate with adjustable wing discs, which rotated around a fixed cupola-shaped cockpit, while Meith had developed a discus-shaped plate in which adjustable jets were inserted. Reportedly, the flying saucer had a diameter of 42 meters, which calculates to 137.76 feet, a height from base to canopy of 32 meters, or 104.96 feet, and had reached an altitude of approximately 40,000 feet with a horizontal flight speed of 2,000 kilometers per hour, which is 1,250 miles per hour, a speed in that day undreamed of. So far, so good. But what I now came to was a series of small and puzzling contradictions. Shortly after the war, Flugkapitän Schreiber was living at Hochstrasse 28 in Bremerhaven, Lehe, from where he announced that the flying disc had indeed been constructed, that it had been ready for testing in April 1945, but that with the advance of the Allies into Germany, the test had been canceled, the machine entirely destroyed, and his papers either mislaid or stolen. Schreiber's story was, however, contradicted by alleged eyewitness George Klein, who later stated that he had actually seen the test flight of the Schreiber disc, or one similar, on February the 14th, 1945. A certain doubt may be cast on Klein's date, since according to the war diary of the 8th Air Fleet, February 14, 1945, was a day of low clouds, rain, snow, and generally poor visibility. Hardly the conditions for the testing of a revolutionary new kind of aircraft. Nevertheless, according to author Renato Vesco, in his thoroughly documented book entitled Intercept UFO, the test flight of a machine called the Kugelblitz, which was rumored to be a revolutionary kind of supersonic aircraft, was successfully conducted over the underground complex of Kala in Thuringia sometime during that very February of 1945. By 1975, Luftfahrt International was stating that a certain World War II Flugkapitän Rudolf Schreiber had died in the late 1950s, and that found among his papers were the incomplete notes for a large flying saucer, most of them technically out of date, a series of rough sketches of the machine, some of which had obviously been redrawn and updated just before his death, and several newspaper clippings about himself and his supposed flying saucer. Now, while none of the designs would have led to a workable flying saucer, Luftfahrt International did include reproductions of the designs of both Schreiber and Dr. Meiss, and also pointed out that Schreiber, right up to his death, had been convinced that the unidentified flying object sightings since the end of the war were proof that his original ideas had been taken further with successful results. Could this be true? Let us examine the possibilities. According to Schreiber, what appears to have been the final version of his flying saucer was constructed at the Bavarian Motor Works plant near Prague in the early months of 1944 and was ready for testing in the early months of 1945, according to reports, February. According to other reports, it was ready for testing in April 1945. According to George Klein, a similar flying disc was actually flown near Prague in February 1945, and according to the Italian author Renato Vesco, who seems unaware of the existence of the Schreiber legend, an extraordinary new flying machine called the Kugelblitz was tested sometime that same month over the complex of Kala in the mountain region of Thuringia. Tying in with this information is the fact that the gas turbine section of the Bavarian Motor Works was originally located in the suburb of Spandau, near Berlin, where, according to Renato Vesco, a lot of research on the Kugelblitz was undertaken, that it was later moved to the underground plant of Wittringen, near Saarbrücken, but that it finally ended up, as from 1944, in seven enormous underground complexes in both Thuringia and Nordhausen in the Harz Mountains. That whole area, running in a metaphorical arc from the Harz Mountains down through Thuringia, Böhmen, and Mähren, was to form the Germans' last redoubt, and as such was littered with a staggering number of underground military and scientific complexes, including the enormous and invaluable metalwork factories and the personnel and equipment from the experimental center at Peenemünde. Certainly, while history was to decree otherwise, it was from there that Hitler intended to defend the remnants of the Third Reich with a whole underground army and the arsenal of secret weapons he had been promised by his scientists for so long. In May 1978, at Stand 111 in a scientific exhibition in the Hanover Messe Hall, some gentlemen were giving away what at first sight appeared to be an orthodox technological tabloid paper called Brisant. This paper contained two seemingly unrelated articles, one an article on the scientific future of the Antarctic, the other an article about Germany's World War II flying saucers. The flying saucer article reiterated the information mentioned before, but added that the research centers for Project Saucer had been located in the areas of Böhmen and Mähren. Now, regarding this, folks, it should be pointed out that Prague is in Böhmen, and that Böhmen is more or less surrounded by the metaphorical arc of the Harz Mountains. Thuringia and Mähren, all of which areas contained vast underground research complexes, none of which were more than a few hundred kilometers from Plague. I should have said Prague, not Plague. And, of course, this coincides with the story of the test flight in 1945, witnessed by the one gentleman, and the accounts of Renato Vesco that the Kugelblitz was moved to and assembled underground near Thuringia. He had no knowledge of a test flight. The article also included a detailed drawing of a typical World War II flying disc, did not mention the designer's name, and claimed that the drawing had been altered by the West German government to render it safe for publication. Adding weight to his argument, the unknown author then pointed out that during the Second World War, all such inventions, whether civilian or military, would have been submitted to the nearest patent office, where under paragraph 30A and 99 of the Patent und Strafgesetzbuch, they would have been automatically stamped secret, taken away from their rightful owners, and passed on to Himmler's research establishments. And according to the article, at the end of the war, some of those patents disappeared into secret Russian files, others into equally secret British and American files, and the remainder disappeared with various missing German scientists and SS men, many of them brought to the United States under Project Paperclip. Since neither the British, the Americans, nor the Russians are ever likely to reveal what precisely was discovered in the secret factories of Nazi Germany, it is worth noting that in 1945, Sir Roy Fedden, as leader of a technical mission to Germany for the Ministry of Aircraft Production, reported, quote, "I have seen enough of their designs and production plans to realize that if they had managed to prolong the war some months longer, we would have been confronted with a set of entirely new and deadly developments in air warfare," end quote. And by 1956, Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, then head of the United States Air Force's Project Blue Book, was able to write, quote, "When World War II ended, the Germans had several radical types of aircraft and guided missiles under development. The majority of these were in the most preliminary stages, but they were the only known craft that could even approach the performances of the objects reported by UFO observers," end quote. Now, I find that absolutely amazing and extremely revealing. The same article went on to point out that in 1938, Hitler, anxious for a foothold in the Antarctic, sent an expedition commanded by Captain Alfred Richter to the coast due south of South Africa. Daily, for 3 weeks, two seaplanes were catapulted from the deck of the German aircraft carrier Schwabenland, with orders to fly back and forth across the territory which Norwegian explorers had named Queen Maud Land. The Germans made a far more thorough study of the area than the Norwegians had done, finding vast regions which were surprisingly free of ice. Their planes covered 230,000 square miles in all, photographing almost half of that area. They also dropped several thousand metal poles, each marked with a swastika, and pointed at the heavy tips so that they would dig into the ice and remain upright. This job done, they renamed the whole area New Schwabenland and claimed it as part of the Third Reich. According to Brissant, German ships and U-boats continued to prowl the South Atlantic Ocean, particularly between South Africa and the Antarctic, throughout the whole of the Second World War. Then in March 1945, just before the end of the war, two German provision U-boats, U-530 and U-977, were launched from a port on the Baltic Sea. Reportedly, they took with them members of the flying saucer research teams, the last of the most vital flying saucer components, the notes and drawings for the saucer, and the designs for gigantic underground complexes and living accommodations based on the remarkable underground factories of Nordhausen in the Harz Mountains. The two U-boats duly reached New Schwabenland, more correctly known as Queen Maud Land, where they unloaded. What they unloaded, no one knows. Finally, 2 months after the war, the same U-boats surfaced mysteriously off the coast of Argentina, where the crews were handed over to the American authorities, who interrogated them at length and then flew them all back to the United States. About 1 year after this, the United States launched the biggest operation ever known regarding the Antarctic. While the stated purpose of the operation was to circumnavigate the 16,000-mile Antarctic coastline and map it thoroughly, Brissant felt it odd that Operation High Jump, under the command of Antarctic veteran Admiral Richard Evelyn Byrd, included 13 ships, two seaplane tenders, an aircraft carrier, six two-engine R-4D transports, six Martin PBM flying boats, six helicopters, and a staggering total of over 4,000 men. It was also considered odd that when this virtual assault force reached the Antarctic coast, they not only docked on January 27, 1947, near the German-claimed territory of Neuschwabenland, but then divided up into three separate task forces. That expedition became something of a mystery, even unto this day. Subsequent official reports stated that it had been an enormous success, revealing more about the Antarctic than had ever been known before. However, other, mainly foreign reports, suggested that such in fact had not been the case, that many of Byrd's men were lost during the first day, that at least four of his airplanes inexplicably disappeared, and that while the expedition had gone provisioned for 6 to 8 months, the men actually returned to America in February 1947 after only a few short weeks. According to Brisson, Admiral Byrd later told a reporter, I could find no verification on this, that it was necessary for the United States of America to take defensive actions against enemy air fighters which came from the polar regions. And again, we can find no substantiation of that statement. And in the case of a new war, the United States of America would be attacked by fighters that are able to fly from one pole to the other with incredible speed. Also, according to Brisson, shortly after his return from the Antarctic, Admiral Byrd was ordered to undergo a secret cross-examination, and the United States withdrew from the Antarctic for almost a decade. What was being suggested then is that throughout the course of the Second World War, the Germans were sending ships and planes to the Antarctic with equipment for massive underground complexes, that at the end of the war, the Flying Saucer Project's team of scientists were taken from Germany by submarines U-530 and U-977, that the Americans interrogated the crews of those submarines when they docked in what they had thought was a friendly Argentina, that the Americans then, upon hearing of the Antarctic base, organized a military task force disguised as an exploratory expedition, that expedition was subsequently put to disarray when it came up against the extraordinary German saucers, and that the United States then pulled out of the Antarctic temporarily in order to build their own saucers based on the designs found in Germany after the war. Now, there's a lot more in this introduction, and it is an extraordinary tale, but it is backed up by so many facts, ladies and gentlemen, that it had better not be dismissed. Because I'm going to tell you something right now. If your television set is broken, you don't go to New York for the answer. You better look behind it and make sure that it's plugged in. The same for this UFO phenomenon. Don't go to Alpha Centauri to find the source of something flying around in our own atmosphere. Because I'm going to tell you right now, the odds are that it originated right here. The substantial amount of information from my own personal research over the last 26 years, ladies and gentlemen, tells me that UFOs are a secret technology developed first by the Germans, then later by the United States, the Soviet Union, Great Britain, and Canada. These are not wild statements at all. In fact, there is no proof existing anywhere upon this earth for an extraterrestrial origin of what is known as the UFO phenomenon. But there are mountains of proof that say they are here, they are human-owned, human-operated, whether they are remote-controlled, are flown by pilots on board those craft, is unknown. Who, in fact, actually owns them and operates them remains also unknown. Although we can prove that some of them, at least, have flown and possibly, on some occasions, still do fly out of a secret base in the desert of Nevada, which you will find on maps as Groom Dry Lake, which is known to the military and to those of us who have studied it for many years as Dreamland, Area 51, or the Ranch. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. Don't miss tomorrow night's broadcast, and God bless you all. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to purchase Man-Made UFOs 1944 to 1994, send $25 post-paid. Make checks or money orders payable to Annie, A-N-N-I-E, and send them to the Intelligence Service, Post Office Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. The address will be repeated at the end of this broadcast.